Okay, so now I'm going to actually call to order this conference committee on House Bill 2128 and welcome everyone. Obviously, this is a very new situation for all of us. First time we've done a virtual conference committee, and hoping that we can get this to go smoothly. We have a lot of work ahead of us here. First of all, I would like to, just for procedures, ask members to keep their feeds muted, ask everyone on the call to keep their feeds muted, and then raise your hand if you would like to ask a question. And then I'm told that you should leave it up until the staff puts your hand down again. So we're going to start today. First of all, I think we do need to call the roll. So Ms. Niedernhofer is going to call the roll just of the conference committee members, both House and Senate. So we'll hope that's the way to proceed. If it isn't, we'll have a roll call that we don't need at worst. So Ms. Niedernhofer, please proceed.
Liebling.
Present.
Schultz.
Present.
Gomez. Oh, I see she's logging in right now. Pinto.
Present.
Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Benson.
Present.
Abler.
Yes.
Utke.
Present.
Horan. Hoffman.
Present.
Quorum is present.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Niedernhofer. Okay, the next thing on the agenda is to have a very brief introduction of the House and the Senate bills. And we're hoping to do this about 10 minutes aside. And I wonder if the Senate would like to go first. Senator Benson, would you be prepared to do that?
Yes, I can do that. So thank you, Chair Liebling, for bringing us into this, as you said, new space. The Senate for the health side took a very straightforward approach to the budget. These two agencies have been through a lot in the past year, and so we're going to take the lessons learned from COVID, lessons learned from civil unrest, fund stability in the department, but look at reforms going forward. I am aware that the capitation delay is an issue for many listening, but we hope that there is more good than bad, and that we can come to good compromise for the benefit of Minnesotans. We did fund 6 months of MA. I think that that is a good step towards helping moms and babies have a solid start. We took action related to doulas, helping pregnant moms who are using illicit drugs to not be referred to child protection. Senator Housley brought in the Vivian Act, which would help with early screening children with a rare virus that can cause disabilities. On dental, we added periodontal treatment and focused on administrative simplification and more transparency for dentists. We also created Dental Home pilot project so that we can learn how to improve what has been a thorn in the side of many policymakers, and that is dental access. We are focused on stabilizing pharmacy access in greater Minnesota and hope that we can find good compromise, including reform to the preferred drug list as brought forth by Senator Dibble and an increase in dispensing reimbursement. For healthcare infrastructure, we have provisions for both HCMC and Regions Bed. We fund our public health, local public health, and EMSRB with both regional grants and improved training. We took a position on continuing to reform opioids, including providing medical gas relief, SUD exemption, and relief from the fees for opioids related to vents. We funded this by bringing in the McKinsey settlement as it relates to the opioid lawsuit that is ongoing. Background checks, we know, are a concern, and I believe a concern shared by the House, but we have funded mobile units to expedite compliance for the non-FBI compliant background checks. On health coverage, we have significant telehealth provisions in the bill, thanks to Senator Rosen. Reinsurance sixth year is funded here. We bring in ARPA funds from Minnesota Care, and we work on both price transparency and removing the PBM gag clause. We did support MDH's operating adjustment for asbestos, radioactive material inspection, and health data intermediaries. And so Senator Abler has much more innovation, I would say, on his side of the budget. And so I would appreciate it if he would speak to those provisions.
All right. Thank you very much, Senator Benson. Senator Abler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't need very many minutes. So maybe Senator Hoffman just wants to offer a comment when I'm done. We'll just piggyback our time. And so in the Senate, these were decidedly separate bills. They've been, you said you had three together in yours. Our two halves even had separate spreadsheets as we were doing our, we got the target sorted out between us, and then we did our own work quite a bit. And actually, we've spent 5 years sorting out how to do this, and I think this has been the cleanest. And so just in the terms of the whole bill, if there's a title to it, it's Independence, We Mean It. And if you recall, in the last couple of years, we've been working to help people with disabilities live more independently, and they get snagged up by all kinds of reasons. But this bill is full of ways to leverage that to happen. And we took full use of the federal money, which I'm going to encourage us to do as we move forward. I'm concerned that as we get closer to the real numbers here, that it may well be that the tax bill from the governor and the House aren't going to be the ones that prevail with the money. And I was looking at the tails, and I see the House is supported by some of that. And just, I don't know how you broke out who gets what if that money goes away. But there's some significant tail support with both the budget reserve and that. So we'll have to, I think the general fund's going to be very precious. I think the federal funds and childcare and the block grants and the increased FMAP are going to make it really possible for us to get something done. And so hopefully that can sort out. But basically what this bill does, it attempts to shore up a community ravaged by the effects of COVID, not just in terms of health, but in terms of the ability to have people staffing up to be there. We've attempted to support the independent side, elderly waiver, PCAs, money beyond the governor, not so dissimilar from your numbers. And home care and a whole lot of those activities to make it easier for the individuals to live independently, which is our desired thing. And so I'm eager for the process, and so I purposely went short so Senator Hoffman could have like a minute or two. So if that's okay, Madam Chair, I would appreciate
Absolutely.
That. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Abler. Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair, nice to see you. And team, I've been watching Health and Human Services for 20 years, and both when I worked on the federal level and also worked at the Pacer Center and just being involved. And I have not seen this broad approach to providing supports and services to people that are the most vulnerable in the state of Minnesota. And the way Senator Abler did it, Madam Chair, was, you know, bold initiatives and uncovered many stones. It reminded me of Linda Berglund, actually, at many moments. But the process, Madam Chair, is that this was a very bipartisan effort. It included me and my team in every step of the way in the conversations. And specifically, when you look at how he does a PCE rate increase of 20%, we're seeing some schooling to mental health bills, substance use disorders. He's doing some bridging, and within those bridging moments, you would note that there's equity involved. As we look at the students with disabilities, we look at adults with disabilities, there's an intersectionality. Senator Abler addressed that in this bill, Madam Chair. And so it was a privilege to be able to work in a bipartisan manner this year on this bill and bring it to this conference committee. So thank you for this moment.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much, senators. So I'll just start off on our side talking a bit about the House bill So it's interesting to me that I think it was Senator Abler who used the word ravage for what COVID has done. And I would use that word as well. This has been an incredible year in Minnesota and in the whole world, with COVID really ravaging our nation. And we don't need to repeat the numbers that are infected and people who've died. And there may be a lot of long-term health consequences, in fact, to the pandemic, even among survivors. But one of the things the pandemic really has done is showed a spotlight on the importance of having a robust public health system and also on the systemic inequities that exist in our state. So fortunately, we do have a budget surplus, and the House is using a large part of that to meet the needs of Minnesotans now and prepare for a healthier future. Our bill is spending real dollars that we know are available. It's been discussed that, what's going on in our tax bill. Our tax bill funds itself. We are not funding this bill by raising taxes. This bill is funded by the surplus, by money that is actually available. So, and of course, we are open to spending additional federal dollars as we get guidance on how those can be used. And we're very fortunate that Congress has allocated additional dollars to be used because they are desperately needed. So the health portion of the bill that I'll just go through very quickly, and then other members will talk about other parts of the bill, but we do invest in public health infrastructure to address our ongoing challenges and meet new ones as they arise, especially among communities that have experienced the worst disparities. We are building a better healthcare system to help all Minnesotans live healthier lives and receive the care they need when they need it. We're investing in children and families, and I think we do share a lot of priorities with the Senate in this regard. We're investing in children and families, and we want to reduce disparities and give our kids the best possible start in life. And we are specifically investing in improving dental care for almost 20% of Minnesotans who are on our public health care programs. That's a pretty astounding number, almost 20%. And we reduce the cost of prescription drugs. So those are just a few of the items. It's a very broad bill. It has the work of at least 43 different House members in it. As we counted, I think it's actually grown. It might be 44 now. And over 100 different provisions that came from members of the House. So we're extremely proud of this bill. And I'm going to turn it over to Representative Schultz to talk about some of the provisions that she worked with more closely. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Really excited to be in conference committee. I'm optimistic that we can put together a strong bipartisan health and human services bill. You know, we are spending on the House about almost $350 million above base. So we had a healthy target. This is a strong health and human services bill. And I'm excited about many provisions. I'm going to talk about a few. First of all, we're investing in people across the state. We're making a huge investment in people. And the biggest investment we're making is spending over $200 million on personal care assistance. This is a sector that has not seen wage increases or benefit increases, and we have shortages and high turnover of PCAs. So we're going to be increasing their wages as part of the SEIU contract. Also, we're increasing the PCA framework rates. So we're doing a double increase there. And we're also covering parents and spouses so they can get reimbursed as PCAs. And this is a really important investment that was desperately needed among PCAs. We are also investing in behavioral health and mental health. We're looking at substance use disorder reforms, trying to get more providers into the demonstration project so they get enhanced rates and we can see better outcomes and higher quality of care. We are investing in the recovery community organizations by funding grants. We're also investing in mental health uniform service standards to make sure that providers in mental health can focus on providing care and not on administrative burden. We're also investing a sober home oversight study to look at sober homes. This was an Edelson bill. And then in another sector, we're building a more representative healthcare workforce. And this is work done by Chair Fisher. We're making sure that alcohol and drug counselors are eligible for loan forgiveness programs. We're allowing DHS Children's Mental Health Grants to be used to provide supervision to clinical trainees from BIPOC communities. We're establishing a culturally informed and responsive mental health task force, and we're increasing diversity on licensing boards. We're also funding a culturally and linguistically appropriate services in substance use disorders and mental health. And we're funding ICWA training. So this was in the governor's proposal, invests in the Indian Child Welfare Act and the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act, training and development for county child welfare and protection staff. We're also looking at repayments for tribal and county governments, and we're looking at some COVID changes to make those permanent. That was a Representative Wolkelmott's bill. And Chair Gomez is going to talk about the investments in homelessness supports, and Chair Pinto is going to talk about child welfare and maltreatment and child care. So I'll turn it over to Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good to be with everyone this morning. I wish we were in person, but it's good to see all your faces. So this bill really is about, you know, giving everybody in our state the ingredients that they need to have a good life. You know, we all need access to economic security and to safe and stable housing. And as more and more families are finding it really impossible to make it in this economy where wages are stagnating for working class people, even as the richest are getting richer and the cost of housing and other necessities are spiking, people are really falling off the edge. And when we allow people in our communities to fall off the edge, we pay, like we pay today and we pay further down the road. So this bill provides an extra one-time payment to families who are enrolled in the Minnesota Family Investment Program to help with extra costs associated with the pandemic. This is like a stimulus payment. It goes right into our economy. It's a good policy and we're glad to have it in our bill. Also helps stabilize those families by establishing just like a basic annual cost of living increase that's tied to CPI or the consumer price index. It does a couple things to raise the income limit for SNAP and streamlines the application and certification processes for economic assistance programs so that both applicants and our agency staff and everybody is like spending less time doing paperwork, which is a good thing. This bill also, you know, I chair the Preventing Homelessness Division, and this bill makes major investments in the issue of homelessness, which is particularly important as emergency shelter providers have really had to like totally reorder the way that they do their work in response to the pandemic because they have folks living in these congregate settings. So we invest both in shelter and those supportive services that are so critical to getting folks into permanent housing. Finally, this bill also modifies our medical cannabis program pretty significantly. We have a super restrictive program in the state, one of probably, if not the most restrictive in the country. And consequently, the cost of this medicine, which is sometimes literally the only thing that brings a patient relief, is very high. It's so much higher than the cost in the black market and so, or the illicit market. And so this is our attempt to expand and kind of loosen some of the really restrictive parts of this program, most significantly by including raw cannabis as an allowed delivery system, are really attempts to, you know, drive down cost and increase access for patients who really need this critical medicine. So thank you so much, Madam Chair, and I'm looking forward to the work together.
Thank you, Representative Gomez. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and hello, everybody. A pleasure to be with you virtually, at least. So the Chair Liebling referenced there being three bills pulled together in this one, and the smallest piece came out of my committee, the Early Childhood Committee, which did have its own public budget target and its own separate bill, but they were combined in Ways and Means. I should note that a portion from my committee went to the Education Conference, Education Path in that conference committee, and there's quite a bit of intertwining between some provisions in our bill and over there, so I'm sure we'll sort that out. But the thing is, as this bill contains provisions from the Early Childhood Committee, it really overall, I think you've heard and what's been presented so far, really prioritizes getting every child off to a great start. So there is that emphasis on prenatal care and maternal health and on home visiting and on the economic supports Representative Gomez mentioned. A few of the particularly exciting pieces in the early childhood space is that we increase rates for our child care assistance program to the 50th percentile. So that's the median. When I've been around the country and mentioned that we're at the 25th percentile, other legislators' jaws drop. This would simply get it to that level and reprioritize waiting lists to get more learning and care to vulnerable kids. This is paid for entirely with federal dollars through the budget horizon. Many of these kids receive their learning and care from family, friend, and neighbors. We provide support for those types of providers, for kids with disabilities, those in foster care. We stabilize and expand the supply of early learning and care in a variety of ways. We invest in physical infrastructure and skills for teachers and caregivers, and then continue the monthly grants that have been going out through the pandemic, and want to direct that to individual teachers and caregivers. We've got a lot of reforms to regulation, including things coming out of the Family Child Care Task Force. They're just a critical part of this work. And then we've got a lot of reform and evaluation, including to Parent Aware, which is our quality metric system in our state. And then I just did want to highlight, as Representative Schultz mentioned, a few points regarding child welfare and maltreatment. Quite a lot in the bill regarding that. We fix a problem under which some low-income kids who need residential treatment have to go through child protection in order to get that treatment. So imagine that you've got a stable family, very supportive family, and now they have to send their kid through child protection just to get that kid the treatment that child needs. We establish an alternative path in child protection to address situations involving sex trafficking, because right now traffickers may need to be interviewed as if they're a caregiver, even if they're not. We really should be addressing that. We raise the age at which kids who are acting out are redirected from the child protection system to the juvenile delinquency system. That current age is 10, and we would want to make sure that a 10-year-old is receiving the correct support in the child protection system. And finally, we've got a lot of grants to support and empower parents who are going through that child welfare system. So important to empower parents and have them receive the support they need so they can make sure that their children receive the support they need. A lot of exciting things in the bill, and really looking forward to the discussion over the next few days. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Representative Pinto. And Representative Schumacher, I don't know if you wanted to have a moment to speak as well. Certainly happy to hear any comments you might have, or if you're not prepared to do that, that's certainly fine as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not prepared for anything at this time. I'm sure I'll have comments as we go along. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. We're glad to have you on the team here, and you're a very valuable part of this process as well, and thank you for your participation. Okay, so with that, the next item of business on our agenda is to go through the fiscal spreadsheet. We're going to share this sheet on screen. And just for anyone who might be watching, we have a very large spreadsheet. I think it's 33 pages. And of course, it has on it now the provisions from both the governor, the House, and the Senate. So this very large spreadsheet. And we've asked the fiscal staff to walk through it at a pretty high level, because if we did this item by item, we would be here probably for 2 days just doing that. So I'm not sure who's going to start.
Madam Chair, I think I will start, and Mr. Albrecht and I will trade off a little bit. Just to orient members a little bit, what we're going to try to do is give you a very summary view of some of the funds on the first page that's on your screen now. And then we'll try to, rather than the traditional look at each item in both positions, we're going to try to look at the larger items that pretty arbitrarily are at $5 million savings or spending or greater in the 22-23 biennium. That's still a fair number of items, but as the chair mentioned, if we did everything, it would take a great deal of time. For the members' benefit, if you look on the sheet in front of you on your screen, and it should have been distributed to members, The shaded columns in the middle represent the House position. The columns on the right-hand side are the same years for the Senate position, and we are showing the summary columns for the governor, but in the interest of space, we just showed the summary there. And as you know, on the front, we show the totals for the whole bill by fund, and I am only going to look at the highlighted lines. Line six is our net general fund expenditure above base. And if members will look at the House position in, you have to get the net general fund for the 22-23 biennium, the way the spreadsheet works, you have to add together the changes in 21, 22, and 23. So you see in the House number in 22-23, it says 375,089,000, but then that is offset by the, if you look at fiscal year 21, there's a reduction of 26.9 million. So the net expenditure out of the general fund above base for the House position is 348,180,000 out of the general fund and 300,105,000 in the tails. I won't go over every line. You can see the other funds below that. I will just make note that line 11 is the statutory funds, which is where you'll find in the House and Senate positions the federal CCDBG money. And line 13, which is the federal funds line, which is where you'll find in the House the child care stabilization funds, and the Senate also uses those and some other federal funds as well. And we'll talk about those in individual items as they occur. Going down to line 22, just for members' benefit, they usually want to know about the Healthcare Access Fund. The House line you see for the Healthcare Access Fund spending, these are cumulative numbers. So each year adds into the next. If you go to the House's ending position, in fiscal year 25, the House has got a savings of 13.460 million by over the four-year period. And if you look on line 25, that drops to the bottom line of the Healthcare Access Fund, which in the February fund balance had zero balance in 25. In the House position, it has a $13 million balance. And then going down to line 30 rather, on the TANF position, it works the same way. The House has a cumulative change of 54, this is spending, of 54.882 million out of the fund, and it leaves a balance you see on line 32 of $122,000 at the end of the four-year time horizon. And at a very summary level, that's the House position. And I'll let Mr. Albrecht comment on the Senate numbers.
Thank you very much, Mr. Berg. Mr. Albrecht.
Madam Chair, good morning, everybody. So the similar numbers for the Senate, beginning on line six, the Senate's target for fiscal years 22 and 23 was zero. And you can see that by looking at the amount for 21 and the total for 22-23, which offset one another. And then the Senate amount for 24-25 is $50.635 million in the general fund. Mr. Berg did a good job of pointing to lines 11 and 13 and how they present the amounts for the Child Care Development Block Grant and other federal funds. For the Healthcare Access Fund, the Senate's position is a zero balance in fiscal year 24 and 25. That's shown on line 25. And for the TANF fund, we typically look mostly at the balance at the end of 4 years. So for the Senate at the end of fiscal year 2025 is a balance of $25.977 million.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Albrecht. And I know you're both going to go through some of the spending and savings items in the bill, but I should mention to members that We will be happy to take questions. So if members do have questions, I think we should let our fiscal analysts get through each section and then take questions from members if there are any. But are there any questions at this point about what we've gone through? And do please use the raise your hand function. All right, I'm not seeing any questions. So Mr. Berg, are we going back to you for the spending?
Yes, Madam Chair, and Mr. McQuillan, if you could go down to line 132, the first highlighted line. All right, members. This is on line 132 is the House and Senate positions on the CCAP program maximum rates. And this is a bit complicated. I'm sure we'll want to talk about this in more detail at another time. For members' interest, the House's position uses the federal the ARPA CCAP funding that came in and adds that to the governor's position. The governor had a 30th percentile of the most recent survey. The House moves that up with the ARPA funds to the 50th percentile of the most recent survey and also does the basic sliding fee reprioritization item. That spends a total of $184.1 million in 22-23 and $274.6 million in 24-25, all from federal funds, except for the $12,000 cost each biennium from the general fund for systems. And I'll let Mr. Albrecht characterize the Senate position.
Mr. Albrecht?
Madam Chair, so the Senate's position is the current law 25th percentile, and it would be of the 2021 rate survey. I'm sorry, I cannot see the top, so I'm losing track of the years. There we go. So for 22-23, the Senate's position is $31.4 million, and for the tail is $52.4 million. And the next item is near the bottom of the page. This is the Senate's allocation of the Child Care Development Block Grant money from the American Rescue Plan. The same amount of money that the House uses for rates over 3 years, it's $212 million. And beginning on line, they're kind of blurry. Anyway, the detail lines below there show the individual proposals that the Senate uses that money for. And they go on to the next page. And so at the top of that page, you can see that one of the larger portions is money that is transferred to the Department of Education for early learning scholarships. And then there is a significant investment in one-time investment in the basic sliding fee child care program of a little over $14 million a year for 3 years. The next one is Senate Bill 1762. This is an allocation from the Federal Child Care Stabilization Fund of $10 million per year for 2 years for provider startup grants. The next one is also an allocation from the Child Care Stabilization Fund, both we line these up, they're not exactly the same. The Senate has a $50 million one-time allocation for a child care facility revitalization grants. The House's position is $5 million one-time for a already existing statutory program that serves a similar purpose for child care providers. The next one, it looks like maybe line 175 is the Senate and the House positions for child care public health grants. Again, an allocation from the Federal Child Care Stabilization Fund. The House has $317.4 million for that proposal, and the Senate has $252 million. And Mr. Berg will do the next one.
Madam Chair and members, the next one is actually below the threshold, but I highlighted it and the next four items just because this is a confusing area where the House and Senate did a number of same or similar things or similar purposes, but have done them out of differing funding pools. Mostly this is coming from either CDBG or stabilization funds, although I will note the House House position on the next page on child care for disabled children, which I believe the Senate funds later in the sheet out of general fund money, but the House funds out of stabilization money. So at some point we'll probably need to look at the child care CCDBG and stabilization items separately or as a together. All right, Patrick, the next yellow line is good, which is line 205. This item is a funding for the residential treatment and children's mental health item. This is House File 944. This is a House only position that has 5.9, almost 6 million in 22-23, and also 5.9 million in 24-25. This is, members may have heard of the third way, or this is the position that is attempting to make it so that parents do not need to have their children entered into foster care to receive mental health benefits. And Representative Schultz can talk more about that issue if there are details. If not, next item, Patrick, which is on line 322.
Oh, and, you know, I just should note, Mr. Berg, it's actually Polly Cervenik.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Who's operating the slideshow today. So Polly would be the person, yeah.
Okay, and this is a Senate provision, right?
At the bottom of page 7, yeah?
Yes.
Madam Chair and members, this is the Senate's position to provide additional funding for the MFIP Consolidated Fund. This portion is from the TANF Fund, and it's $5.6 million in the first biennium and $10 million in 24 and 25. The next highlighted item is on the next page. This is the Senate's position to increase the MFIP housing benefit by $40 per month and is a little over $18 million in 22 and 23 from the TANF Fund and $19 million in 24 and 25. Next on line 334 is an allocation in the Senate from the federal pandemic emergency assistance amount. And this is additional funding for emergency assistance grants. There's a $10 million allocation that carries with it its own language and is very similar to the current law emergency assistance program, but has additional and expanded permitted uses of the money. And then the $4.3 million goes to the MTRIP Consolidated Fund, with the proposal earlier to have that be a $5 million per year increase each year in the amount for the MTRIP Consolidated Fund.
Madam Chair and members, the next item is on line 339, is a governor's provision that the House picked up and is not in the Senate, is the MFIP cost of living recommendation from the governor. It has a total cost of $13.6 million in 22, 23, and $38.5 million in the tails. That is a mixed group of general fund and TANF funds. So this affects both of those funds and is, as I say, only in the House position. Polly, the next position, I think, is a Senate position.
So this is the Senate's rate increase for home care providers. It is structured so that the commissioner would determine the actual proportional increase for providers that would spend the amount allocated, the $9.7 million in 22, 23, and $10.3 million in 24 and 25. The next proposal is Senate File 319. This is a rate increase for housing support providers that has increased appropriation of $5.9 million in 22, 23, and $14.2 million in 24 and 25. Next item is at the bottom of page 11. It's part of Senate File 933. This is an allocation from the federal mental health block grant for school-linked mental health grants of $2.5 million per year ongoing. The next item is an allocation from the Federal Substance Abuse and Treatment Block Grant. It's for the Opioid Epidemic Response Grants. These are the grants awarded by the Opioid Epidemic Response Advisory Council. And it would be $3.5 million per year ongoing. The next proposal is the Senate's temporary elimination of caseload growth in the CADI and DD waivers from fiscal year 22 through the end of fiscal year 2025. And that would reduce spending in medical assistance by $64.6 million in the first biennium and $211.4 million in the second.
The next item is the homelessness grants and projects item. The governor had a position on this of $21.3 million. The House takes a somewhat different approach than the governor and spends $25 million in each biennium for purposes of the Emergency Services Grants Program, emergency shelter grants, and also the long-term homelessness supportive services program. Next item. On line 594 is the PCA service rate increase. This is the PCA contract. The House has essentially the same money as the governor. I believe there was a small study that was deleted, so it is just slightly different. And it spends 67.6 million in 22-23 for the terms of the contract and 103.9 million in 24-25 for the contract. And the Senate position is somewhat different, and I'm not sure what the difference is there. So,
Mr. Albrecht, can you help us with that?
Madam Chair, the Senate's PCA proposal is similar to the governor's. It's more money allocated to the rates with a similar mechanism as the proposal I just discussed earlier, where the commissioner would work with the money that the Senate appropriates and determine the rate increase that accompanies it, with $76.9 million in 22-23 and $125.7 million in 24-25.
Okay, thank you. Madam Chair, I see Senator Abler has his hand up. I don't know if it's...
Oh, thank you. I have my screen set in such a way that I did not see that. Okay, and I see Representative Schultz does too. So let's pause on this for a moment. Senator Abler.
Well, thanks. And just to mention, yeah, all I can see is the screen share too. So I found my little box to raise my hand. just to point out that what the Senate did with concern about what the non-union providers tell us is that they don't have enough money to meet we had a long discussion about wages and rates, and I hope we don't go back into that in this conference, Madam Chair. It was 15 minutes of head-spinning nuance, but it's kind of interesting if you're really wonkish. But anyway, they had a hard time meeting the rates that we were targeting, and so we simply put in 20% more money into what the governor had spent, figuring we'd sort it out here. And you have the framework, we just have an add on to the bucket. And it wasn't our intention to go beyond the contract pricing. And it's also important to emphasize that in our bill, we did not ratify the contract. We put the money toward it and figured that would also sort itself out. So thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question if this is federal funds for this PCA increase in the Senate side.
Mr. Albrecht?
Madam Chair, no. It's, as you can see online, I can't read those numbers. They're all blurry. Anyway, the detail amounts match up with the House and the Senate online, on general fund lines.
Representative Schultz?
So is that coming from the surplus then? Or is it coming from federal funds that are put into the general fund and then used? How is that coming through to the general fund?
Mr. Albrecht?
Madam Chair and Representative Schultz, I don't think I understand the question. It's just general fund money.
So Representative Schultz, I don't know if this helps, but, you know, I mean, money is fungible. So once it kind of goes, I mean, there is a variety of money coming into the bill. And I don't know if you can track, maybe Mr. Berg, maybe you can help me on this if I'm wrong, but it's hard to track.
I guess maybe the way I would explain this, Madam Chair and Representative Schultz, is that the Senate bill uses a variety of funding sources as the House bill does. There is not any direct connection between federal funds and this item. It simply spends the Senate's allocation of general funds as this, on the House side, spends the House's allocation of general funds. And so there's no direct link between spending of federal funds and this item.
Senator Abler?
Well, thank you. And I think that's a fair representation. I just do want to make sure people understand that in our bill, we did spend, $228 million of what we calculated the FMAP increase would be, which we thought is certainly justified in our area, and we'll discuss. I think we really think we should figure out a way to spend that between ourselves here. We also spent the block grants, the SUD and the mental health ones, as well as the child care federal money. So beyond that, I'm just helping people understand our funding streams. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Abler. Representative Schultz, any more on that piece?
I think that was helpful. So some of this money could be coming from the enhanced FMAP rate for home and community-based services, Senator Abler?
Senator Abler?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Representative Schultz, yes. And as Mr. Byrd pointed out, I don't know how you track which dollar goes to what. We also had three ways that we generated some savings in the bill, which we'll discuss at a later time. Those also would be commingled in here.
Madam Chair?
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, Representative Schultz.
So if the federal government gives us more guidance on that enhanced FMAP and they let us know that we can only spend it over 1 or 2 years, does this cause problems for this budget for the PCA increase after 2 years?
Would that be or would that be a question for Mr. Albrecht, maybe?
Madam Chair, Mr. Albrecht.
Okay, Mr. Albrecht.
Madam Chair and Representative Schultz, I think the effect of additional federal guidance wouldn't influence the Senate's position on any one particular proposal. It might influence the Senate's overall position, but I don't think, as I said, that you could point to one that additional federal guidance would affect.
Okay. And, you know, I think it would be useful, especially to me, I guess, and maybe to other members, to talk about the FMAP. And, of course, for anybody who's trying to watch this, you need the dictionary to know what these acronyms are. We use so much jargon in this committee, and we kind of have to because we've got so much to cover here. But let's maybe put a pin in the FMAP question, because I think when we maybe get to the end of the spreadsheet, it would be helpful to just have our analysts talk a little bit about what that is and how it can or cannot be used. So I think it's kind of an important question for our whole setup here. Senator Abler?
Well, thanks, Madam Chair. And perhaps when the commissioner comes, they could outline their particular current view of what they think about the FMAP. And maybe they could, if she's willing to, she could comment on their view of the substance use and the mental health block grants and child care as well, just to give us a flavor. This is certainly going to be a major part of our decision making going forward. If we can use that money, it's going to be a much easier conference committee. If we have none of that, it's going to be really interesting. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Abler. And, you know, I'm sure she's listening. I don't know whether she can adjust her presentation, because we've asked our commissioners to make kind of a brief presentation, but I'm sure she and the staff will, if they can't get to that today, I agree, that's going to be important for us to hear about and understand as we get this very complicated budget together. So thank you for that. Okay, fiscal analysts, and I'm not calling on you individually. I think it's just fine the way you've been going back and forth, and you know how you want to do it. So, Mr. Berg, looks like you're ready to resume.
Madam Chair and members, yes. So, continuing the PCA discussion on line 607, the next one is a House-only item. You heard Mr. Albrecht and Senator Abler say that they had added money on top of the contract cost to put more money into PCA. The House took a different approach on line 607 and created a PCA rate framework. It spends $8.3 million in 22-23 and $39.8 million in 24-25 to set up a permanent rate framework structure to add additional funds into the PCA program.
Madam Chair, the next proposal is the Senate's Home and Community-Based Services Provider Retainer Payments. That is a one-time amount in fiscal year 2022 of $61.1 million.
And if I could just raise a point here, kind of going back to our previous discussion, this is one where, notwithstanding what we understand, that you can't trace a dollar from a particular source to particular spending in the bill. This is one where, at least as we're hearing from the advocates, this is one where the FMAP money, which is the increase in the federal matching amount for Medicaid, that's where this is being spent. Senator Abler, do you want to comment on that?
Thanks, trying to unmute. And Madam Chair, this actually is, you know, and I understand, we all understand the merits of one-time spending and ongoing and, you know, dipping into the reserve, which I think the House does to support some of it. So those are all, and at the end of the day, some of those decisions are going to be not decisions we're making here. But I think that, but in terms of this, this is a really good use. This $61 million becomes $155 million because the FMAP can be matched. And so the design of this is to include everyone in the home and community-based services system, from transportation to living to home care to all those entities on a larger scale, a larger population than who got the summer's $30 million in retainer payments and whatever those health grants we did. And so the idea is over five quarters, they would get the enhanced 10%, which may actually amount to 15 or 20% of what they're getting based upon their billings. And I think it's kind of, we both use the word ravaged. This is going to be a way to help that. And I believe we encumbered it to 50% for staff. So this would be a way to inject 70 or 80 million or whatever into the staff as well. So that's the proposal, Madam Chair.
Representative Schultz.
Yes, I'm looking at line 644 and 645 of the spreadsheet, and it looks like that's where we can see how the PCAs and these retainer payments are paid for. So if staff want to go and explain those lines.
If whoever is controlling the spreadsheet could move to those lines, that would be helpful.
Representative Schultz, please give the lines again.
644 and 645. It's the next page.
Yeah, it's the next item.
Okay, and then Mr. Albrecht, were you gonna?
I can talk about this item, but there's no direct link between this item and any other item in the Senate's position. So this is the Senate's proposal relating to the enhanced FMAP for home and community-based services. It is based on two things. One is a projection of what is the MOE requirement in the federal law. It assumes that the MOE amount would be determined by looking backwards for 1 year before the effective date of the federal position. And assumes that that will be the amount of spending that the state is required to continue spending on home and community-based services in order to get the 10% enhanced FMAP rate for home and community-based services. Then the next step is to project the spending based on our forecast for the 1 year in which the enhanced FMAP would be available, the 10% increase. So that is April 1st of 2021 through March 31st of 2022. The amount of that is $478 million. That is the amount on line 643. And then it compares, once you incorporate that enhanced FMAP into the overall spending of the state on home and community-based services in that period and compare that to the maintenance of effort requirement, the difference is $228.3 million that the state would have to spend on home and community-based services in that year in order to meet the maintenance of effort requirement.
Representative Schultz.
Yes, thank you. So that is helpful to know that the Senate's position is using the enhanced FMAP for PCAs and for the retainer payments. Thank you.
Yeah, and if we could just, yeah.
Madam Chair, I would defer to Senator Aber, but as I said, there is no direct link between this proposal and any other proposal in the Senate's position.
Okay, well, so here is kind of the question that I have, and for either of our fiscal analysts, when we talk about the enhanced FMAP, and again, you know, for people who might be listening, let's see, what does FMAP stand for? Federal MA percentage?
Madam Chair, federal medical assistance percentage.
Percentage, okay, I was close.
Participation, excuse me.
Okay, so what this is, and I see Senator Benson has her hand up too, but what this is where the federal government pays a percentage of Medicaid. And under the pandemic, there are increases that the federal government is paying beyond what they usually pay for us. And so my understanding is what the Senate is doing is capturing that increase and directing it back into the budget in various ways. And the question that I have about that, normally the way this works is that it drops to the bottom line of the budget, and we in the House see this in our target or not that is allocated to us. It doesn't necessarily come back into the Health and Human Services budget. And then also there are requirements around federal programs that determine what we can use federal money for. For example, in Medicaid, what we call medical assistance, generally speaking, we have to match the federal portion with state money. And throughout this pandemic, when we've had various forms of federal money, we've been told you can't take federal money and use it as the state matching portion. So there are all these restrictions around there, and that's what makes a lot of this really complicated and makes me a little not really clear on what the Senate is doing here. But Senator Benson, maybe you can help me out.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And in the Senate, we have been referring to two different FMAP buckets. So the home and community-based services FMAP. So we labeled that, and Senator Abler has been using that in his portion of the budget, and then new generic, the regular enhanced FMAP. So we have been referring to them as HCBS FMAP and then FMAP. And so there are different requirements, conditions on each of those funding streams. And so I think it would be helpful if our fiscal analysts could refer to which specific type of FMAP they're talking about, and perhaps it will help us gain that discipline because there will be different requirements.
Okay, and Senator Abler.
Well, thanks, Madam Chair. We certainly are a finance committee, and this is actually probably more interesting than some of the conversations we've had for our audience. So your comment about that the $228 million dropped to the bottom line and that the House took the opportunity to use that as building their budget is, I think, you know, a fair way to treat it. It is one-time money. And so however you build your targets, you know, we spent it directly, and it appears that the House spent it indirectly. And so that's, and I just is that
Madam Chair?
Mr. Burke. I'm sorry. Let's Senator Abler finish before we interrupt him. I'm sorry, Senator Abler.
Yeah. No, but just sure. So I mean, it makes sense. It either drops to the bottom line of money as state revenue, that can be used for a purpose, which if it only can be used for our stuff, then you'll have to demonstrate, like we did, that we at least found a way to show that we spent the right amount of money, even though every dollar wouldn't have to be tracked the way it was tracked, but that's just an easy way to make it work out. I'll leave it at that, Madam Chair. I'm not trying to be argumentative. I'm just trying to point out.
No, this is all helpful.
Thank you.
Mr. Burke.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to correct, because while I understand Senator Abler's point, he said something that based on what you had said that's not accurate, that the House does not have the HCBS FMAP either in this spreadsheet or in the House target numbers. Your comment and the point that I think he was making is that that's the normal process that it happens, is that it drops the bottom line and it gets allocated to whatever the surplus is in the general fund, gets allocated to various committees for various purposes. However, the House budget resolution at this point does not include the HCBS FMAP money, and nor does the House spreadsheet. And then to enforce Mr. Albrecht's point, the Senate is bringing money in here to their sheet, which is, you know, it brings money in that's available to be spent in this item, but then how it's spent is a separate issue. And while if they did not have this money in, they would have to make other decisions because they would have a different amount of money available, there isn't a direct line from this infusion of savings to the general fund and any spending proposal that they are making out of the general fund, other than the total issue of how much money is available.
So this seems to go back to Senator Benson's comment that there are different buckets that we're not talking about. When we say FMAP, we might not be all talking about the same thing all the time. Mr. Berg, is that...
Yes, Madam Chair, and to complicate this, this is not the same way it happens, for instance, for like a statutory fund like the CCDBG money, which does not coming in does not drop to the bottom line, although it can have an impact on our general fund spending for the MFIP child care program, but those funds and some other federal funds are treated differently. In this case, with FMAP money of either sort, it impacts the bottom line of the general fund, or, as in the case of the Senate, can be handled directly within one bill.
Okay. Senator Abler.
Albrecht, let him go first.
I think it might be good at this point. Given the very end of Mr. Berg's comment there to note that the federal law that contained this enhanced HCBS FMAP seems to the Senate to be pretty clear that the value of this enhanced FMAP cannot drop to the bottom line and be used for other things. It has to be used for home and community-based services. So it is qualitatively different than the regular Medicaid FMAP.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Albrecht. Senator Abler.
Well, I think just to clarify, to make it clear, so it appears that the House, that there's a couple of bags of money that are sitting in somebody's safe relative to the House budget. This $228 million and probably both block grants are probably just sitting somewhere. They have not been allocated by the House either in their math or in your target, and the Senate has incorporated those. I think that's a fair statement. So at least we know, and those are subject to future negotiation, I would think.
Yes, and Senator Abler, I don't think I would characterize it as sitting in some lockbox somewhere. What I would say is that we didn't have guidance on how this money could be used. And so the House has taken the position that, unfortunately for our budgeting timeline, that we were not able to write a spreadsheet using money that we didn't know if we would be able to use it in certain ways. So I would say, ironically, that our approach is more conservative than the Senate's approach. in that respect. So,
Madam Chair.
Senator Abler.
That's funny. I'm just trying to help. Actually, I'm helping the House with their point there. So, but I believe the bottom line of the House target shows that it's taking some money out of the budget reserve, perhaps $630 million, if that's the right number. But if they had considered this money, there would be a less drain on budget reserve, no matter if it was how it was spent. I'll stop there, Madam Chair. So thank you.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody, for the good discussion. I mean, this is kind of getting to the core of some of the things we have to figure out. So I do appreciate that. So back to our fiscal analysts, if you would care to finish up here.
All right, Madam Chair, for members to move to the last item on this page, on line 660, this is the governor's recommendation for disability grant program grants reductions and alterations. It has a savings of $5.7 million in 22-23 and $1.6 million in the tails. The Senate did not take this item. And next position. And Madam Chair, on line 715, this is the governor's position for rate reform for remote service provisions. The House took this position. Actually, this one shouldn't have been on the sheet because it doesn't raise to the $5 million level in 22-23. It only does in the tails. It saves $2.8 million in 22-23 and 6.9 in the tails. The Senate has a different position on this and does not take the savings from reducing the grants. Unless there are questions, I'll move on.
Madam Chair and members, the next proposal is in the middle of the page there. It is the Senate's position to eliminate parental fees, also known as TEFA fees for medical assistance. The cost for that is $17.2 million in 22 and 23, and a little over $22 million in 24 and 25. The next proposal is an elderly waiver provider rate increase. Similar to many of the Senate's rate increases, it allocates an amount of money and then authorizes the commissioner to determine the actual rate increase that goes with that amount of money. For this one, it's $12.2 million in the first biennium and $14.1 million in the second.
And Madam Chair, that's correct, Polly. On line 768 is the Substance Use Disorder Provider Payment Initiative. The governor had an item which saved significant money. The House has altered the governor's provision fairly significantly. There are savings of $5.5 million in 22-23 and $17.6 million in the tails. That's significantly less than the governor's savings. The House eliminated some of the rate reductions or rate add-on cuts that were in the governor's position and added some enhancements to other rates to get a similar in character item, but with different effects on providers. And the Senate has a different position yet on that, that Dennis can explain.
And I would just note that was a worked on significantly by Representative Peter Fisher, and we'll probably spend some time on this. Senator Abler?
Well, and yeah, we could talk a lot about that, but I didn't raise my hand for this. I just actually spoke erroneously. We're kind of coming to the end of this human services section, it seems like. So when I talked about the retainer payments, I was in error when I said they went to everybody. We did not include groups that already had rate increases in the bill, just to try to sped it further. We can certainly discuss that if you like the idea of the retainer payment. But we did not include PCAs, CFSS, home health, and home care, just so we can be accurate. So,
okay.
The substance use thing is really going to be an important topic as well. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Senator. Please continue, Mr. Berg, Mr. Albrecht.
Madam Chair, Mr. Berg had handed it to me to talk about the Senate substance use disorder provisions, but I have to say I will have to defer either to Senator Abler or Mr. Halswald, because that was such a late development in the Senate's position that I don't know that much about it, except that it's really different from the governor's and the House's.
Senator Abler?
Madam Chair, I'll just really be brief. I think we're probably running long on it, but there's just a considerable concern about the ability for people to enroll and what the rate of uptake is going to be. We've had a lot of meetings with the department. They've been very cordial. This will be worth an hour someday, so thank you.
All right, thank you, Senator. And actually, we're doing okay on time, so let's continue and get through the spreadsheet.
Madam Chair, we can speed up. Polly, can we move to the... No, you have it there, actually. I'm sorry. It's on line 801, or no, excuse me, 788 is the next item. This is the House has picked up the governor's initiative for repayment of the counties and the two tribes for the MAT IMD overpayment issue. The only difference between the House and the governor is the House appropriated it in fiscal year 22 rather than 21. I believe the department has a preference for 21, but the Senate did not pick up this item. On line 792, the House has carried the governor's item for the direct care and treatment operating adjustment at DHS. This is $49.8 million in 22-23 and $57.3 million in the tails. The Senate does not carry that item. On line 801, the House has the funding for the human services portion only of House File 41, which is the Essential Workers Emergency Leave Act. It pays emergency leave to workers impacted by the pandemic. That spends $26.6 million in 22-23 and $20,000 in the tails. This is not in the governor's position or in the Senate position. On line 846 is the House's dental benefits position. The governor had a combined dental and pharmacy position. The House has disaggregated those and done some different things. The House's dental only provision spends $29.9 million in 22-23 and $55.4 million in 24-25. And unless there are questions, I'll move on. The next item is the Senate. The pharmacy benefits one. As I said, the House disaggregated the governor's positions. And for pharmacy, the House is basing it largely on House File 8, which was Representative Liebling's bill. This has a savings of $11.8 million in 22-23 and an expenditure of $25.6 million in the tails. This is different from the governor's item, and the Senate does not have a similar item. Polly, you can move to... Nope, it's on there. The next item is a Senate item.
Madam Chair and members, the next item is the Senate's proposal in the Commerce Bill that extends the Minnesota Premium Security Plan, which is also known as the Reinsurance Plan, for a fifth and a sixth year. And there are costs attributable to the Minnesota Care Program related to that proposal, which are shown here, along with some interactions between the Healthcare Access Fund and the General Fund related to the statutory transfer under 16A.724. The net result of all of that activity is $159.1 million in 22 and 23 and $52.7 million in 24 and 25. The next item right below that.
Mr. Albrecht, before you go on from that, even though it's not on, this is only part of the cost of this provision. I understand some of it is carried elsewhere. And do you have that information just so we have some context? If you it's fine.
Madam Chair and members, the Senate's Commerce Bill has $150 million for the sixth year that would go into the premium security account to make reinsurance payments in that sixth year.
So is that just the same money showing up in a different place, or is that additional money?
It is different money for a different purpose.
Okay, so the total cost is somewhere in the neighborhood of $300 million. Is that what we're talking about when we consider the hit to the healthcare access fund and the general fund appropriation?
Sure. I think so. I don't know. I don't spend much time in the commerce budget, so I don't really add things up that way. I only pay attention to my own budget.
Okay. Representative Schultz has her hand up. I bet she is has more of an answer here. Representative Schultz.
Yeah, I was going to ask the same question, Chair Liebling, about if this is what's the total cost to the state? Are these state general fund dollars, or does this combine federal dollars?
So, Madam Chair and Representative Schultz and members, the reinsurance proposal has the effect of lowering insurance premiums in the state. The Senate's proposal to add a sixth year says to the Commissioner of Commerce, go to the federal government and ask for another waiver to do an additional year than is currently authorized under the state's existing waiver related to reinsurance. And then the Senate puts $150 million into the premium security account to pay the state share of the reinsurance payments for that year. Lower insurance premiums in the state have the result that the amount of money the state receives for Minnesota Care is less, because the Minnesota Care funding is tied to the amount an individual would have received had they purchased their health plan in the private market. We get 95% of the subsidy the individual would have received had they purchased their plan through MinSure. And so when money is used to reduce premiums, that has the effect of reducing federal funding for Minnesota Care. Minnesota Care is an entitlement, so if any $1 reduction from some funding source for Minnesota Care means a $1 increase from some other place. And so in this case, the other place is the Healthcare Access Fund, where Minnesota Care is paid for. And these are the amounts that reflect the reduced funding for Minnesota Care from the federal government for the basic health plan.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Albrecht. And Representative Schultz, did you have any more on that?
No, I'm just trying to understand why we would need to implement reinsurance for a sixth year when we have the new policies from the Biden administration to cap premiums at 8.5% of a person's income for those on the individual health insurance market, which would keep premiums low. And if we do reinsurance, we lose federal funding. So I think this is going to be an item up for discussion about why we need to actually implement the reinsurance. I don't think we need to.
All right. Well, thank you for that. We're shape of things to come in terms of discussion. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think leadership's going to have to decide where the reinsurance discussion is going to take place, and then the money will follow that discussion.
Okay, thank you. All right, let's continue on.
Madam Chair, just to put an endpoint on that discussion, the House Commerce Bill cancels the balance of the premium security account to the general fund. And that, again, that's handled in the Commerce Bill and is not reflected on the House Human Services spreadsheet. On line 898 is the relatively late-breaking item that we, in both bills, are adjusting or allowing DHS to adjust premiums in the Minnesota Care Program to allow us to get enhanced BHP or additional BHP money. The House and Senate take somewhat different approaches to the actual tracking of the money, but the same amount, which you can see on line 902, I believe it is, which is a savings of $122.6 million to the Healthcare Access Fund, is the same in both the House and Senate. There are some other differences. The House has some administrative costs related to it, but this is the same item doing the same thing. There are some slight differences in the numbers. I think we can move on to the next one, line 937. This is both the House and the Senate have versions of a bill that extends MA postpartum eligibility. The House extends it 12 months, and I believe the Senate extends it 6 months. The House item costs $8.8 million in 22-23 and $29.4 million in the tails. And the Senate item costs less because of the 6 months, so it's $8.5 million in 22-23 and $17.3 million in the tails. Essentially the same item, just a different coverage period. Polly, to the next one. On line 957 are the differing positions on telehealth, expansion of telehealth services. The House has $28.1 million in 22-23 and $3.5 million in the tails for expansion of telehealth services, but then sunsets all those services at the end of 2 years. The Senate, well, I'll let Mr. Albrecht characterize the Senate position.
Madam Chair and members, the Senate's position is $31.3 million in 22 and 23 and $9.7 million in 24 and 25. Similar to the House, the Senate continues most of the telehealth services that exist under the commissioner's authority under the governor's peacetime emergency authority, I believe for 3 years, but the Senate does not sunset all of them. The Senate lets some of them, I think the ones that are not the telephone, continue after 3 years. The next item, a few lines below that, is the Senate's medical assistance managed care capitation payment delay. It is a partial delay, a stated dollar amount of $93.7 million of the fiscal year 2023 payments and $114 million of the fiscal year 2025 payments.
And Madam Chair and members, on line 1016, the House picks up the governor's recommendation for uniform administration of non-emergency medical transportation. It has a savings of 21.7 million in 22-23 and 65.7 million in 24-25. The Senate does not include that item. And Madam Chair, on line 1129, the House picks up the governor's recommendation for the Department of Human Services agency operating adjustment. It is slightly different in the House. There is the House spends 12.4 million in 22-23 and 21.9 million in 24-25. The difference between the governor's recommendation and the House position is the House inclusion of a PCA integrity item that costs $1.5 million a year in 22 and 23 only, which is listed separately. And Madam Chair, on the final DHS item is a House only item. It is on line 1155. The governor's supplemental recommendations included this item and the House picked it up. It is 14.3 million in 22-23 and a one-time basis to provide transition from the COVID waivers under the public health emergency to normal operations. And the Senate does not, well, the Senate has a smaller item for that, I guess I should say. Senate.
Madam Chair and members, the next item is the Senate's position for Senate File 1698. I think Senator Benson mentioned this, the Vivian Act. It spends $5.2 million in 22 and 23 and $4.6 million in the tails.
Madam Chair and members, the next item on line 1258 is a House only item, and I'll note that this is a state government special revenue fund item. It is not in the general fund or the federal fund, but it is a substantial item. The House bill allows the use of dried raw cannabis in the medical program. This has nothing to do with House File 600, the recreational program. But the as the fiscal note on sale of use of dried raw cannabis in the medical program generates significant revenue. You can see 8.9 million in net revenue to the program in 22-23 and 10.1 million in net revenue to the program in 24-25. The Senate does not have that item. On line 1258 is an item that is the same for the House, the Senate, and the governor, which is a technical item largely in the state government special revenue fund. It is dealing with what is really an on-paper shortfall in the fund. There is spending authorization at Department of Health that is in excess of what is actually used or needed, so the fund does not have an actual deficit, but this corrects some of the corrects the balance in the spending authority so that there isn't a paper shortfall either. On line 1281 is the House's position to expand home visiting grants. It is 10 million in 22-23 and 10 million in 24-25. And then moving on to getting to the final items on line 13.29 is the House's House File 970, which does a variety of things and has some impact at DHS and at some of the health boards as well. And it provides for training and grants on culturally informed mental health services, I guess I will say is the broad brush. In this case, the Department of Health, it has a cost of $7.6 million in 22-23 and $7.6 million in 24-25. The Senate does not have this item, nor was it a governor's recommendation.
And if I could just add to that, Mr. Berg, I think we could characterize this as a workforce bill. It tries to expand the mental health workforce with people from different backgrounds.
Madam Chair and members, the next proposal is a Senate proposal to reduce healthcare access fund spending for the statewide health improvement program by $10 million per year ongoing. After that is a House provision to increase, to establish, it looks like, new local public health equity outreach funding of $7.5 million per year ongoing. And after that is a Senate and House proposal to increase funding for local public health grants. They're funded differently. The House proposal is $7.5 million per year from the general fund. And the Senate's proposal is $5 million per year from the general fund, and then $10 million a year from the healthcare access fund. The Senate's proposal is combined in some respects, using that $10 million from the reduction in the SHIP grant to redirect that funding to local public health grants.
So if we could just, you know, a pause on this for just a second, because I want to just say a bit more. These three things obviously are all interrelated, all dealing with public health infrastructure, but I just wanted to kind of put a pin in what is called here local public health equity outreach, because obviously this is what I have referred to at the very beginning in my intro, that the pandemic has not affected everyone equally. And this is the House's attempt to build the infrastructure in such a way that we include communities and don't leave communities behind when it comes to reaching out to them for public health, in particular the vaccinations, which we know that there was a lag for these communities, but even being forward looking to make sure we have a more equitable public health system. So I'll stop there just by way of explanation of what this is.
Madam Chair, that's the end of the highlighted items. I'll make just a comment. There are two things that would reach the $5 million threshold that aren't counted here because they're really tactical items. One is the Blue Ribbon Commission revenue offset that all parties, the governor, the House, and the Senate are all tracking the same way. That's really a technical item to make the spreadsheets balance to the general fund statement. And then at the health licensing boards, there is an item that has a $5 million or greater impact, but it is simply moving the administrative services unit from the Board of Executives for Long-Term Services and Supports to the Board of Dentistry. And that's, it's a purely technical move. It doesn't change the administrative services unit. It just moves which board it's housed at. So it involves $5 million worth of money, but it's purely technical.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Are we at the end? We're at the end of the presentation then.
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right. Yes. Well, thank you very much to both our fiscal analysts. That was really helpful to go through it in that way and have you all be prepared with the highlighting and all that. Great. Senator Abler.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just a technical question. I noticed the timestamp was different on the one that they shared with us. And I think that one of the avocations of fiscal analysts is creating more spreadsheets at all hours of the night. It appeared the lines lined up. So is the one we're using, which is timestamped May 3rd at 4:45, still the right one to be using?
Madam Chair. Madam Chair, yes, that members should continue using the May 3rd at 4:45. I will tell you there was a very slight formatting issue change that happened, and when Mr. Albrecht sent it to me and I went to do the highlighting, I mistakenly did not pick up the one that had changed three line numbers in it, and so I had to redo it this morning with a different number. Nothing changed in it other than three blank lines that were deleted. It changed no numbers, and I would tell members to continue with the May 3rd at 4:45 non-highlighted item that was sent out to all members and staff should have, and I believe is posted on both the House and Senate websites.
Thank you, and Madam Chair, just want to make one other comment.
Please.
And just in terms of the equity thing, I think that there's going to be a lot of talk about that. And in our committee, we spent a good deal of time talking about equity. But there's Senator Hoffman can do this conversation much more better than I can. But the people with disabilities are left off the list. And a good deal of the groups you would consider to be concerned with equity actually have a high level of disabilities. Persons with disabilities, the homeless, the mental health, I think that's really pretty important. And even on the PCA levels, a good deal of the groups that we're trying to reach out into the equity population actually work in those arenas. So just to point out that some things are more overt, you say equity here. I think a lot of our equity is more just under the radar, but I think it's a lot of it's there. So just to point that out, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Abler. And I was just to go back to our talking about our spreadsheet for a moment. I just wanted to say to the public who might be watching, you get a taste here of how tough the job is for our fiscal analysts. And thank you so much for your work. I mean, Mr. Burke's talking about the few minor little errors. I mean, this is just an incredibly hard thing to get right. And I know, I'm sure Mr. Albrecht works about as hard as Mr. Burke does, but I just really, he is working 24 hours a day, it seems, some of the time. So thank you both for your really great work on getting this really complicated spreadsheet together. So I understand that was Senator Coran might have been trying to raise his hand, and I see Senator Hoffman has his hand up. Was Senator Coran, did you have a comment?
No, Madam Chair.
Oh, okay. I guess I got that wrong. Okay. All right, Senator Hoffman.
That was me, Madam Chair. I don't know how to. I'm looking at multiple screens here. Raise hand. So I was raising my hand, literally raising my hand, but I appreciate you doing that. Yeah, one of the things we really talked about within the committee, Madam Chair, is when we define equity. You know, and I'll just give you a quick snapshot. When you look at a demographic breakdown of poverty by race, right, and we'll just look at African-American, 20% are impoverished, right, without disability. When you add the disability piece in there, that jumps to almost 40%. And so there's this whole piece about if we're going to talk equity, are we also making sure that we're having intersectionality discussion about that? And I have some sheets I'll share later on in this discussion that will help us kind of see how that picture really looks, because you just can't isolate it. You got to make sure that you're including. That's how our conversations were in all this, Madam Chair, and to Senator Abler's point. So thank you for allowing me to give a brief intro to that. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. And we probably should spend some time talking about that and about how our proposals here impact that, because one of the things that we've come to understand, and this might be a bit different than what you're saying, Senator Hoffman, I'm not really sure, but when we talk about where within the disability community we allocate our resources, which services and who uses what, we also within the disability buckets should pay attention to equity within that. And so, for example, we've come to understand that the people who use PCA services are much more diverse, not to mention the people delivering those services are more diverse than in some other areas. So, you know, I think this is a great discussion for us to have. I don't remember in previous years our really having that discussion. So I look forward to that. Thank you.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. You're right on the PCA discussion, and actually Commissioner Harpstead has some numbers on that as well. When we're increasing the amount of money to the PCAs, we're also increasing that equity piece. And so thank you for bringing that up, and I look forward to this lengthier discussion on it.
Right. Okay. So members, well, thank you. Thank you again to the fiscal staff. So we are a little bit beyond our plan time, but not too bad. And this has all been, I think, a really helpful and valuable, at least it has been to me. So, and I hope to others. So next, we're going to move into the section of our hearing where we hear from the commissioners. And first, we're going to hear from Commissioner Malcolm and then from Commissioner Harpstead. And I would just note that they have each submitted a letter, which are in your packets as well. So welcome, Commissioner Malcolm.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the conference committee. I do appreciate the opportunity to make some brief comments. And for detailed comments, I would refer you to the letter that Madam Chair just spoke about. I'm certainly, in the interest of time, will not reiterate all of that here, but I'm very happy at any point to answer any questions on the issues raised in that letter. Certainly, the words are hardly sufficient to describe what this year has been like, and this last 15 months has been like for public health at the local level as well as the state level. And I want to start off by saying that the recognition in both the House and the Senate for the critical role of public health, the support that you have given to us at MDH and to your local public health agencies is deeply appreciated. The good questions you've asked, the suggestions, I think have made us better in our response. I will always be proud of the way Minnesota has responded to this pandemic, that our citizens have the interest of the whole community. Many people and businesses have made sacrifices for the good of the whole. And our healthcare systems have stood up and done an incredible job of improving care and of collaborating with each other and with us in public service. And I just can't say enough about the level of effort. It's taught us a lot, and I think it will take us a while, frankly, to fully absorb all of the lessons from this pandemic and to understand all of the impacts that it will make in a lasting way on the human services system and on the healthcare delivery system. And I do believe some of the issues and some of the lessons will be important for us in years to come as we seek to really look at systemic improvements to strengthen the whole public health and healthcare continuum through the lens of what we've learned here. And again, I just really want to appreciate the recognition of local public health in particular in both the Senate and the House positions. I want to thank both the House and the Senate as well for your support for several of our policy proposals and several of our housekeeping priorities. They may seem small, but they are important to keep the work moving forward. And in terms of the budget, we're very appreciative of both bodies' inclusion of the governor's proposals making this state government special revenue fund adjustments for newborn screening and asbestos and radioactive materials programs. Those are both very valuable programs that serve broad public health benefits, and appreciate your inclusion of that. In terms of some specific comments on House positions, I'd really like to thank the House too for including some of our additional policy proposals, like adding general surgery to the International Medical Graduate Program and updates to the Groundwater Protection Act. I want to thank the House for shoring up the public health emergency account at MDH, which was so very important to us at the beginning of this pandemic, and both bodies were extremely supportive of us using that fund quickly. I think when the legislature passed the first COVID funding bills last March, we didn't have any line of sight to how massive this was going to be and how expensive the response would be at all levels of government. And we really appreciate attention to sustaining this kind of an investment in an ever-ready public health response account. As part of the House's support to local public health, I do appreciate the focus on health disparities. The COVID vaccine rollout has been one of the most ambitious public health endeavors ever in our country. And again, I'm very proud of Minnesota's robust ecosystem of vaccinators of all stripes who have enabled us to be one of the leading states in the nation for in terms of the share of our population vaccinated, especially the most vulnerable. However, and Madam Chair, you spoke to this, we know that not all communities have yet benefited equally from vaccines, even as some have been harder hit by the pandemic than others. And certainly the lens of vaccine equity is very critical, and we must continue those efforts to close those gaps in vaccination rates. As well, I think the House language is intended, as you said, Madam Chair, to help us incorporate some of those lessons and embody that and embed that in some of our health equity work going forward at the department and in local public health. I do appreciate the, I'd like to just take a minute just to respond to Senator Abler and Senator Hoffman on the question of what is included in our definition of equity. And I appreciated that conversation in your committee and in other committees as well. Even as we, I just want to assure you that we do absolutely consider people with disabilities and the issue of intersectionality as being included in our approach to equity. We've recently set some equity, specific equity targets and have been explicit that people with disabilities are included in that definition of equity. So I appreciate your focus on that and assure you that we are quite aligned on that view. With respect to House positions, thank you for including the overall operating adjustment for the department's overall needs to help us maintain our current services. Of course, we know, as does everyone, the cost of business rises each year, and we do take very seriously our obligation to try to find ways to find efficiencies and to set priorities. But occasionally, we do see that we are falling behind in our capacity to meet the needs that the public expects of us and that the legislature expects of us through the programs that you've established and the duties that you've given us. So appreciate that general operating inclusion. And while we very much appreciate and recognize that the SGSR adjustments are operating increases to those specific programs, they do not help with the overall needs of the agency. So hope that the Senate will consider and agree to the operating adjustment as well. Moving on to some Senate positions, I want to thank again the Senate and Chair Benson for the ways in which this Senate positions also prioritize prevention and local public health. Appreciate the attention to local public health in particular. But as I noted in some detail in my letter, I believe that the Senate's funding mechanism by reducing SHIP will have some unintended consequences. I strongly believe that we need SHIP on a statewide basis and strong funding for the core services of local public health, and that it should be a both and not an either or. And can talk certainly later on, whenever time is most appropriate, about some of the evidence behind SHIP, some of the impacts, and some of the what I consider to be unintended consequences of some funding shifts that would happen were you to adopt the Senate's funding mechanism here. But certainly one of the things also we know through the lens of COVID is some of the largest sources of increased risk are the comorbidities that come from chronic conditions, which is exactly what SHIP is aiming to impact on a statewide basis. Now, with respect to health disparities, again, this is a priority that we very much share with the Senate and the House. And while I really welcome the proposed development of model curriculum on anti-racism and implicit bias for hospitals, particularly with obstetrics care and birth centers, because we know that infant and maternal mortality is actually a significant issue of health inequities and one of the best upstream things we can do to affect lifelong trajectories. I really appreciate that idea of developing that model curriculum. However, I don't believe that taking money from other grantees through the Eliminating Health Disparities grants is the best way to pay for it, and hope that we can have some dialogue about other funding mechanisms for this important work. Another point here with respect to licensure of abortion facilities, our position is that this requirement is not a needed new level of regulation, given that these facilities are already regulated through physician licensure rules set by the Board of Medical Practice. With respect to an issue that is not in this bill, but I think is supported by both the Senate and the House, with respect to tobacco cessation and prevention, this does remain one of the leading causes of premature death and illness and avoidable healthcare costs in our state, and reiterate the importance of including some new investments in cessation and prevention in the tobacco bill that is currently in the Taxes Committee. This is going to be an important resource for further reducing commercial tobacco use and new forms of addiction, such as vaping in Minnesota. So appreciate this committee's assistance and attention to the need for some of those resources to be dedicated to prevention. In closing, I just want to reiterate the incredible year that this has been. And while public health at all levels has been pretty consumed by the COVID response, we have also learned how reliant we are on the public health infrastructure for a whole range of other issues. And that work has continued to the best of our ability at state and local levels. We need public health to do so much more than emergency response, but we absolutely need it to be fully prepared to respond to emergencies as well. But on the broader front, we just continue to need to keep our eye on the fact that prevention, particularly of chronic conditions, is one of the best things we can do to not only improve the health of Minnesotans, but to improve the health of our economy as well by managing healthcare costs in the most sustainable way, in the most win-win way, in terms of reducing costs and improving health and productivity at the same time. So I hope that we will continue the great discussions we've had over time about the need to have a very intentional investment strategy in prevention, as well as funding interventions that are needed when problems are developed, and particularly in the realm of chronic conditions. The great majority of those conditions can be delayed, prevented altogether, or ameliorated by prevention strategies. So finally, I just want to thank you, Chair Liebling and Chair Benson, and the members of your committees and this conference committee for the hard work to get to this point, for your support of local public health and our staffs throughout this difficult year. It's good to be here in this, while it would be preferable to be in those crowded conference rooms, it's good to see you even virtually, and really look forward to these next couple of weeks and stand ready to assist in any way as you do this very challenging work. Thanks for the time.
Well, thank you so much, Commissioner Malcolm, and what a time to be the Commissioner of Health. My goodness. And we do appreciate your leadership, and your staff has worked extremely hard and been really great to work with throughout this whole thing. And thank you so much to all of you. Commissioner Harpstead, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, chairs and members of the HHS Omnibus Budget Bill Conference Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to address you today as you begin your work. We've also submitted a letter, as you've heard, with more detailed comments on specific provisions in each bill, but I want to take some time today to share some thoughts on what I hope we can accomplish by the time this session has concluded. As you've heard me say many times, Minnesota is highly ranked nationally in its services for older adults and people with disabilities, and we very much support independence for them and services that allow them to stay in their own homes or family homes and work in competitive jobs and community as long as they would like. A key strategy to achieve this goal is to make a meaningful investment in PCA services that work to keep older adults and people with disabilities out of more expensive congregate care settings. We are also all aware of the painful data that shows that Minnesota is ranked very low nationally in racial equity, which shows up across all ages. As such, we must also strive for Minnesota to become the best place for children to grow up, all children. I am appalled at how far behind Minnesota has fallen in childcare rates, dental health, behavioral health, infant maternal health, and support for lifting children out of deep poverty. DHS is committed to improvements in, as we say, mental health, dental health, and rental health. The COVID pandemic exposed many holes in our state's safety net, including the number of people who are precariously housed or experiencing homelessness. Our DHS deep poverty report documented that rents in Minnesota have increased by 12% since 2000, while wages of renters has decreased by 5%. Unfortunately, we will need a robust shelter strategy until we can build enough affordable housing for all. As I've testified, if there was ever a program whose design got in the way of its very purpose, it's the Minnesota MFIT program. When we finally move to 6 months versus every month reporting, we'll be the last state in the nation to do so. I know we would all like to see MFIT recipients filling out job applications instead of MFIT paperwork, as would they too. And study after study has shown that simple cash payments work very effectively to move families out of poverty, which is why that strategy is the one most supported by their advocates. We must address good government, of course, every budget year, like operating adjustments and federal compliance. And this year, background studies and getting back to better coming out of COVID-19. I'm pleased with the take-up of strategies discussed by the Blue Ribbon Commission. We will need them to help us close out the budget. I'm pleased with many of the overall values and specific proposals in both omnibus bills. I have valued our partnership with our HHS chairs throughout COVID as we've worked together on waivers and other flexibilities to help our communities weather the pandemic. And I look forward to working with you as usual to sort out the differences between your proposed budgets and the governor's and to examine the potential of federal funding to find the best approaches we can all agree on to support Minnesotans in coming out of the pandemic. Chair Liebling, Dave Greenman has a brief presentation called What We Know So Far About Federal Funds, if that would be helpful. Thank you.
Okay, well, I didn't know about that.
It came up in previous conversation before our testimony.
Okay, well, we had hoped to start in on Article 1 doing somewhat of an overview of that, and we are kind of running a little bit. If it's just a few minutes, I think we could do that. I think this is obviously a topic we're going to want to return to probably more than once, but Mr. Greenman, if you can, is it just a few minutes that you have for us on this?
Madam Chair, yes, it's just a few minutes.
Okay, all right, go ahead.
Okay, Madam Chair, Dave Greenman with the Department of Human Services. I was just gonna talk about the home and community-based services, the enhanced FMAP for that piece of it, rather than, I know that there's other federal funds in the, purely in the Senate bill, which we can certainly talk about more about at a later time. But the enhanced home and community-based services FMAP increase, what we know is that it's a 10% increase in the federal medical assistance percentage for a 12-month period, and the period is April 1 of 2021 to March 31st of 2022. based on our calculations, that would amount to approximately $475 million in savings to the state as a result of the enhanced federal funding. The federal law does define what is included in home and community-based services to include things like home health, case management, personal care, the 1915 waivers, which are waivers for elderly and disabled folks, the PACE program, and other things that the secretary may designate. So we don't know exactly what those are. We know that the funds or the savings that we recover from those that we collect from the enhanced FMAP have to be used to cannot be used to supplant existing state spending. And it must be used to supplement or implement spending to enhance or expand or strengthen home and community-based services. As you know, we don't have guidance yet from the federal government on some of the more specific details of this. It's really hard to, some of the things that we have questions about right now include the period in which we have to spend the savings from the enhanced FMAP, whether that's 12 months, whether that's 24 months, or whether that's 48 months, we don't know that yet. We don't know what type of spending is allowed under the non-supplantation rules. For example, we don't know whether we can spend the savings on covering the cost of forecasted increases in programs that don't go beyond new things. They're just existing program spending growth. We don't know if they can be used for that. We don't know what other services the secretary is going to designate as home and community-based services. We don't know the consequences of the state not spending the enhanced FMAP within the required period. And we don't know whether the savings from the enhanced FMAP must be spent on MA services or whether it can be spent on home and community-based services that don't qualify for MA. So that's, in short, that's what we know about and what we don't know about the home and community-based services. When the guidance comes out, I'm sure it'll be on the bestseller list for all the conferees. We certainly have more information about what we know and what we don't know about other federal funding as well. And we're happy to share that whenever the time is right for that.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Greenman. And yeah, I think it would be helpful if you have even a brief write-up of the information that you just gave us that you could share with members or share with our committee administrators, and we could get that out to members of the conference committee. I think that would be very helpful because this is going to be kind of a central question, and I don't want to spend more time on it right now, but I think, you know, obviously this is going to form a lot of our decision-making. And I think as Senator Benson might want to remind us, a lot of this will be decided above our heads of how much money and what money we'll be able to use. So we would defer the further conversation on that right now, I think. Commissioner Harpstead, did you have anything else you wanted to share at this time?
No, thank you, Chair Liebling.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your presentation today. Let's move on then. We are going to start to do sort of a modified walkthrough of some of our articles. And just like when we talked about the spreadsheet, this is a very, very large bill. These two bills are very large bills. And so we don't want to spend tons of time just, you know, marching through every single provision in them. We're going to have to depend on members of the conference committee and staff, and of course, members of the public who are interested to actually read what's out there and posted. And to, of course, comment to members through email probably is the most efficient way if you do have comments on various provisions. But we're going to start with an overview of House Article 1 and just do the highlights of that article. So I would like to call on I think, well, nonpartisan staff, I think we're starting with House research staff or House staff.
Madam Chair, Randy Chen with House Research. I'll start with Article 1.
Thank you, Mr. Chen. And, and Mr. Chen, could you just orient members to which document you are working off of? We got, we have like three documents related to Article 1, if I'm not mistaken. And go ahead, Mr. Chen.
Sure. Madam Chair and members, instead of walking through the side-by-side summary, you know, which is a longer document, we'll be operating off a document, in this case for Article 1. It's called List of Sections, House Article 1, and then Senate Article 1. It's a you know, two-page, or actually it's a four-page document. So this lists the House section, the Senate section, whether or not there's a cost, description, and a comparison. So we'll be going through each of the major provisions, but we'll be sort of grouping sections together, so we won't be going through every individual section. And I just wanted to point out that the cost column, you know, is subject to change as we talk more with House and Senate fiscal staff. So starting with House sections 1 to 5, these exempt the MA and Minnesota Care programs from private sector insurance mandates. Then moving to House sections, beginning with House Section 6, and there's several other sections listed. This requires the Department of Human Services to contract for the administration of non-emergency medical transportation services, or NEMT services, under both fee-for-service and managed care. These sections repeal the prohibition in current law on using a broker, and it also allows the use of competitive bidding. Then House Section 7, Senate Section 8, these are identical. They expand use of the encounter alerting service. Then Senate Section 9, this requires agency reporting requirements to expire after 3 or 5 years, depending upon the type of report, unless the provision specifies sort of an end date for reporting. Then moving to House Section 8 and Section 32, House only, it allows DHS to use more than one base year to set inpatient hospital, federal qualified health center, and rural health clinic rates. Then there are a number of sections beginning with House 9 and going on, and the corresponding Senate sections. These establish a directed payment arrangement for Hennepin County Medical Center that would involve intergovernmental transfers and provide HCMC with higher reimbursement rates through managed care. And this language is similar in both bills. Then House Section 10, the language that's in paragraphs D and E, these clarify the criteria for disproportionate share hospital or DSH payments. It's House only. Then House Section 10, paragraph G, and then House Sections 43, 47, and 65. This is the carve out of outpatient drug coverage from MA managed care contracts. The House sections also increase funding for certain hospitals and 340B providers that have high levels of dispensing either 340B drugs or high-cost drugs. And these sections also require a study of the expansion of this carve-out to Minnesota Care and also to the private sector. Then House Section 11, Senate Section 13, these sections extend the time period that which hospitals have to appeal base year rate information with DHS. So this is identical language. Then House Sections 12, Senate Section 14, this provision allows tribal agencies to be eligible to receive fraud prevention grants. The language is identical. Then House Sections 13, 23, 48, 49, 57, and 58. These sections require DHS to contract with the dental administrator, and it carves out dental services from MA and Minnesota Care managed care. It replaces the current system of a base rate and supplemental rates with a new higher base rate. And it also provides a 20% critical access dental provider add-on, but it eliminates a lot of the other supplemental dental payments. Then House Sections 15, 33, and 35, these established in an MA enhanced asthma benefit. It's House only. Then there's a series of sections beginning with House 16, and then beginning with Senate Section 15. These extend MA postpartum coverage from the current 60-day limit in law. The difference is the House extends this 12 months and the Senate to 6 months. Then House Section 18 and Senate Section 17, this links the asset limit for qualified Medicare beneficiaries to the Medicare low-income subsidy level. This language is identical in both bills. Then there's a series of sections beginning with House Section 20, Senate Section 19, makes changes related to the Health Services Advisory Council. It's identical in both bills. Then House Section 23, Senate Section 22. This section expands adult dental services to include coverage for periodontal disease. And this section is identical on that, but the House section also has some language related to the dental carve-out. Then there are two Senate sections, 23 and 24. They establish a uniform prior authorization process for dental services and also a uniform credentialing process for dental providers. It's Senate only. Then House Section 24, Senate Section 25. This allows MA to dispense and cover a 90-day supply of certain cost-effective generic drugs. So language is identical. Then House Sections 24 and 45, this requires reporting on reimbursement for 340B drugs. So both the health plans and the 340B covered entities would have to report on this. So this is House-only language. Then House 25, Senate Section 26, this deals with the DHS Formulary Committee expiration, which is currently June 30th of 2022 in current law. The House removes this expiration date, so it makes the committee ongoing, and the Senate language does not do this, but makes a technical change in that section. Then House Section 26 would require MA to cover weight loss drugs. It's a House-only provision. Then House Section 27, Senate Section 27, these sections are identical. They increase the MA dispensing fee from the current $10.48 to $10.77. They also require separate measurement of the cost of dispensing for specialty and non-specialty drugs. Then Senate Section 28, this requires DHS to hold a public hearing and consider certain factors before removing a drug from the preferred drug list. So it's Senate only. Then Sections 29 and 39, these require pharmacies and other entities that dispense drugs to under MA to be located within within Minnesota. And it also requires the Medicaid managed care plans and other to comply with this requirement. So it's Senate only. Then House Section 30 allows DHS to provide monthly transit passes to non-emergency medical transportation recipients. Then House Section 34, this specifies additional requirements for child and teen checkup services or EPSDT services. It also allows DHS to contract for the provision of these EPSDT services, mainly for children who are enrolled in an integrated health partnership. So it's House only. Then House Sections 36 and 53,
These exempt HIV drugs from the MA and Minnesota Care copayments. Then a series of sections beginning with House 37 and Senate Section 31. They modify the operation and membership of the opioid prescribing work group. So these are identical. Then House 40, Senate Section 34. Eliminates the requirement that PCA providers who are working for an agency enroll as individual providers. So this is identical. Section 40 of the Senate, Senate only, requires managed care plans and dental benefit administrators to make fee schedules available to dental providers upon request. Then House Section 44 requires managed care plans to provide information to DHS on provider payment rates and for DHS to report annually to the legislature. So these would be the mean and median payment rates by county for specific service categories. Then House Section 47, Senate Section 42 clarifies the use of Medicare payment methods for outpatient hospital rates. These sections are identical, but again, the House language has some drug carve-out provisions. Then House Sections 50 and 51 clarify language related to the Integrated Care for High-Risk Pregnant Women program. So this is House only, and the House has a rider providing funding for this in Article 21. Then Senate Section 43 requires DHS to report on the effectiveness of maternal and child health policies and programs in addressing disparities in health outcomes. So it's Senate only. Then, again, a series of sections, House Sections 52, 54, and 55, and the corresponding Senate sections. These modify Minnesota Care eligibility determination procedures to reflect the federal denial of a state waiver request. So that's identical language. Then House Section 56 allows persons subject to the family glitch to be eligible for Minnesota Care. That's House only. Then Senate House Section 59 and Senate Section 47 adjusts Minnesota Care premiums to reflect federal reductions in qualified health plan premiums. So there are technical differences only here. Then Senate Section 48 increases Minnesota Care premiums by 10% for persons who use tobacco products who are not participating in a tobacco cessation program. Then House Section 61, it allows DHS to take certain actions to maintain current MA and Minnesota Care policies if the Affordable Care Act is overturned by the Supreme Court. House Section 62 requires the department to report on alternative methods of delivering care under MA and Minnesota Care. Then House Section 63, Senate Section 51, these sections require a study of a dental home demonstration project, and there are a number of differences in both bills. Then House Section 64, it exempts payments from the St. Paul Guaranteed Income Demonstration Project from being counted as income or assets when determining eligibility for certain DHS programs. Then Senate Section 50, this is the delay in incapitation payments for May of 2023 and also for payments that would be due in May of 2025. So this is Senate only. Then House Section 67 requires DHS to develop a proposal for a public option and to report to the legislature. Then House Section 68, it allows DHS to suspend collection of unpaid premiums and also the use of periodic data matching for up to 6 months following the end of a public health emergency. So that's House only. Then Senate Section 53 exempts durable medical equipment and other providers from being financially liable to the federal government for certain overpayments related to the Medicare competitive bid program. It also requires the state to repay the federal government with state funds. then Senate Section 54 requires DHS to report recommendations for a new formulary committee to the legislature. Senate Section 58 requires DHS to develop an MA reimbursable recuperative care service. Then House Section 69, Senate Section 60, this is a revisor's instruction related to the renaming of the Health Services Advisory Council, so that's identical. And then there's a, the last section would be a repealer, House Section 70, Senate Section 61. The Senate repeals the Healthcare Access Fund transfer to the General Fund on July 1st of 2024. The House and the Appropriations article repeals this on June 30th of 2025. And then also the House repeals the child and teen checkup rules and certain non-emergency medical transportation provisions. So that concludes the walkthrough for Article 1.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chun. That, you know, I just want to say that these summary documents are very helpful. And thank you to all the staff. I'm sure you did most of it, but you and everyone who worked to put this together, I'm sure Senate Counsel helped as well. And this is going to make our work a lot easier, I think, being able to refer to and work off these documents. So this is a great start. I just, Mr. Chun, before we move on, and I will take questions from other members or comments if you have them, but I just want to go back to the very first provision on here, which is the House only. And the summary sheet says exempt MA and Minnesota Care from private insurance mandates. And I think that that is not, doesn't quite give a full picture of what this is, because my understanding of this is just that this is just a housekeeping, rearrange the statutes kind of provision. It doesn't actually change anything, at least. So could you comment on that, sure. Mr. Chun? Am I correct?
Yeah. So, Madam Chair and members, that's correct. The department intends this to sort of clarify things for future mandates, because right now it's very confusing whether or not a private sector mandate applies to the HMOs that serve MA and Minnesota Care. Usually, they, you know, I think it's assumed that they do apply to these PMAP plans. But then the question is, what happens to MA fee-for-service? And the department always then suggests, well, the legislature should be explicit about that. So this makes it clear for the future. But in discussing this with the department, they had mentioned that the effect of this would be also to exempt MA and Minnesota Care from current insurance mandates, but that it would not really have an effect on the programs because the MA and Minnesota Care benefits already picked up the current mandates. So I think their thinking was that it would not change coverage under the MA and Minnesota Care programs. But perhaps at some point they could elaborate on that further.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Chun. I know that it was not the House's intention when we adopted this to make any change in the current programs through this language.
Right.
We understood it to be just something that was straightening things out to make administration or to make legislating a little simpler going forward. So thank you for that.
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay, great. And so I think we had Senator Abler and then Senator Benson. Senator Abler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I think you're trying to be brief on this, and I'll be brief too. I just wanted to express a concern about at least one element of this, which falls into my turf, which is the non-emergency medical transportation. And I looked up the chart in the governor's budget. I have not seen the fiscal note on this. I would actually enjoy seeing that if it's around. But just if you remember the incontinence product discussion where they could find a magic 40%, by buying those in bulk, and we struggled with that for I don't know how many sessions, but it just didn't make sense. And I don't think this is going to work. And for some reason the department thinks it can generate almost $90 million of savings, but it requires reducing payments to providers by about $100 million in a biennium, and paying somebody $40 million more. So I just wanted to make you know, Madam Chair, that there's nothing political about this. I just don't think it's a workable idea. So I'll leave it at that, and I'll read the fiscal note, and this will probably come up later. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, right, Senator Abler, I'm sure it will come up later. And, you know, the problem, of course, with a lot of these kinds of issues is that the current system isn't working very well. And so we need change. And we certainly are open to discussing whether this is the right change. And, you know, but the money savings aside, we do need reform in this program. So I hope we will have some good discussion on that. Absolutely.
And Madam Chair.
Yeah, Senator Abler, please.
I remember discussing this topic for, I think, now 2 decades. So, yes, we need immediate change. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the tone.
Yeah, well, you know, we got to start. If we always just kick it down the road and say, well, we don't have the perfect thing, you know, I mean, well, we will. We'll keep discussing this. So, Senator Benson.
Hi. Thank you, Chair Liebling. With regard to the exempting MA and Minnesota Care from private insurance mandates, by leaving them in place, it demonstrates cost to the system of new mandates. And so part of the reason that the Senate didn't pick up this provision is because when we get fiscal notes and it shows tens of millions of dollars of cost to the system, to our public programs, it really does help to clarify what we're asking the private sector to do. And so that's why the Senate didn't pick up this provision.
Okay, well, thank you, Senator Benson. That's helpful to know. I guess I would say that you could always put in your bill that, you know, I mean, you could get that information by structuring your bill such that it included both and then see what the fiscal note says. So I appreciate that. I think it's also, depending on what we're talking about, sometimes the way the public programs work is so different than the way the private market works that it might not be a real apples to apples comparison anyway, but I see your concern there. So thank you for that. Other member comments or questions before we go on to, we're going to do Article 3 next, the Health Department article, the House's Health Department article. Any other comments? All right, not seeing any, and we're kind of back on schedule. So very good. Ms. Clarkvist, is that you're going to do that one for us? Well, wonderful. Please proceed.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Elizabeth Clarkus with House Research, and I'll be going through House Article 3, Senate Article 2, which is the Health Department, and then after me, Ms. Kavanaugh will be going through the Health Insurance Article. So as with Mr. Chen, I'll be using the list of sections, House Article 3, Senate Article 2, Health Department document, beginning with House Sections 1, 2, and 4, and Senate Sections 1, 2, and 4. This is an e-health reduction initiative eliminating certain reporting requirements and department duties related to e-health. House Sections 3 and 7 through 9 and Senate Sections 3 and 5 through 7, these eliminate state certification of health data intermediaries and modify health information exchange requirements. These are the same except for one technical difference. House Sections 5 and 6 are House only, and these modify provisions governing electronic prescribing standards. House Sections 10, 11, 107, and 108 are House only, and these delete language establishing the Center for Healthcare Purchasing Improvement, but retain certain duties for the commissioner. House Section 12 is House only. It requires medical practices to make available to the public a list of current standard charges for items and services that are provided by the practice. Senate Section 8 is Senate only, and it allows the Commissioner of Health to use drug pricing data from other sources to meet the reporting requirements under the Price Transparency Act. House Sections 13 through 15 and 104 are House only. and they allow certain data from the All Payer Claims database to identify hospitals, clinics, and medical practices. House Section 16 is House only, and it expands the sources of data the commissioner can use to derive health risk limits for substances that degrade groundwater. Senate Section 9 is Senate only, and it provides expiration dates for mandated reports that don't include a specific expiration date. Moving on to the next page, Senate Sections 10 and 17 are Senate only, and they require the provision of information about CMV, require the commissioner to establish an outreach program, and require the newborn screening program to test for congenital CMV. House Sections 17 through 20 and 99 are House only, and these relate to COVID-19 vaccine distribution, equitable distribution of vaccines, mobile vaccination programs, vaccine data and reporting, and adding a member to the COVID-19 Vaccine Allocation Advisory Group. House Sections 21 to 28 and 108 are House only, and these make changes to the Resident Reimbursement Case Mix Classification Statute. House Sections 29 to 33 and Senate Sections 11 through 15 are identical except for one technical difference, and these make changes to the licensure fees for radioactive material and source or special nuclear material. House Section 34 and Senate Section 16 are identical, and these increase the per specimen fee for testing under the newborn screening program. House Section 35 and Senate Section 18 relate to continuing education at hospitals and birth centers on anti-racism and implicit bias. And they also address midwife and doula availability, training, and workforce diversity. And there are differences in these sections. House Section 36 and Senate Section 19 are identical, and these add a dentist to the Rural Health Advisory Committee. House Sections 37 to 39 are House only, and these add alcohol and drug counselors to the Health Professional Education Loan Forgiveness Program. House Section 40 is House only, and it makes general surgery programs eligible for grants under the International Medical Graduate Primary Care Residency Grant Program. Sections 41, a portion of 42, a portion of 43, 44, 46, and 91 establish procedures to issue certified birth records and state identification cards to homeless youth and waive fees for this purpose. Senate Sections 20 through 22, 25, and 30 make changes to the vital records statutes related to safe place newborns and also amends the safe place for newborn statute. And those are Senate only. Senate Sections 23 and 37 remove race from the list of marriage certificate data that's required to be reported to the state registrar, and requires marriage license applications to be modified to remove the space to indicate the applicant's race. House Section 42, a portion of that section, allows an entity that administers a children's savings program to access certain birth records to open an account in the program for the child. A portion of Section 43 in the House and Senate Section 24 make changes to who may obtain a certified copy of a birth or death record. The House makes an additional change in this section as part of another initiative, but this portion of the sections are identical. House Section 45 is House only. It allows the state registrar and agents to charge convenience fees and transaction fees to issue vital records. House Sections 47, 48, and 50 are House only. These make changes related to hospital licensure regarding hospital compliance with conditions on which moratorium exceptions were granted. House Section 49 and Senate Section 26 add or modify exemptions to the hospital construction moratorium, and there are some portions of this are the same and some are different. Moving on to the next page, House Sections 51 and 52 are House only, and these require a notice and a hearing before closure of a hospital or hospital campus, relocation of services, or a cessation in offering certain services. House Sections 53 through 56 and 93 are House only, and they modify requirements for lead risk assessments and lead orders. House Sections 57 to 59 and 98 are House only, and they make changes to assisted living facility licensure statutes and to a law governing conversion from registration to licensure. Senate Section 27 is Senate only and permits a hospital to destroy medical records of a patient who is a minor when the patient reaches the age of majority or after 7 years. Senate Section 28 is Senate only, and it establishes licensure requirements for abortion facilities. House Section 60 and Senate Section 29 are the same except for a technical difference, and they place in statute the grant program for home visiting programs for pregnant women and families with young children. House Sections 61 to 64 and 92 make changes to provisions governing WIC, and these are House only. House Sections 65 and 66 are House only, and these make changes to provisions governing access to data and data classifications for maternal mortality studies. Senate Section 31 is a Senate-only section. It places in statute the grant program for home visiting programs that use the nurse-family partnership model. House Sections 67 to 73 and 101 reschedule marijuana and non-synthetic THC from Schedule 1 to Schedule 2. House Sections 74 to 90 are House only, and they make a number of changes to the statutes governing the medical cannabis program. Senate Section 32 is Senate only, and it exempts from regulation under Chapter 157 fellowship meals that are prepared at a faith-based organization and made available for curbside pickup or delivery. House Sections 94 to 97 and 33 to 36 in the Senate increase asbestos licensing certification and permit fees, and these are the same except for a few technical differences. House Section 100 is House only. It allows the commissioner to contract for a review of measures to prevent and control the spread of COVID-19. House Section 102 is House only. It requires the Legislative Audit Commission to consider patient discharges from hospitals to nursing homes as a potential evaluation topic for the legislative auditor. House Section 103 is House only. It establishes the Mental Health Cultural Community Continuing Education Grant Program. House Section 105 is House only. It establishes a Skin Lightening Products Public Awareness and Education Grant Program. House Section 106 is House only. It establishes a Trauma-Informed Gun Violence Reduction Pilot Program. And House Section 108 is the repealer, and it's House only.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Clark. Same comment to you. I think this document is very, very helpful. Are there questions or comments from members on anything in what we've just covered? All right, not seeing any, but we can, of course, come back, and we will come back to all of this. Thank you again, Ms. Clark-Fiss. So we're going to go on now to the health insurance article, which is Article 6 of the House bill. Ms. Kavanaugh?
Madam Chair, Katie Kavanaugh of the Senate Council. I will go through the health insurance article. That's House Article 6 and Senate Article 5. The first section is a House section only, and this deletes references to qualified health plans and the Affordable Care Act in a section in Chapter 62A that outlines required provisions for health plans. House Section 2 is House only. This prohibits a health carrier that offers a group health plan from requiring an individual who is eligible to enroll to wait for a period that's longer than 90 days. House Section 3 and 4, these sections are House only. They require a health policy that covers mental health services provided by a mental health professional to also cover those services if they are provided by a clinical trainee. House Section 5 is House only, and this requires health carriers to offer individual health plans on a guaranteed issue basis with premiums that do not vary based on health status. This is basically requirements that are currently required under the Affordable Care Act. House Section 6 is House only. This permits a health carrier to cancel an individual health plan for non-payment of premiums if a three-month grace period is provided. House Sections 7 through 10 are House only. They remove references to the Affordable Care Act in various health maintenance organization statutes in Chapter 62D. House Section 11 is House only. This section removes, again, references to the Affordable Care Act in a section in 62Q that provides a definition for dependent child. Then we have Senate Sections 1 and 2. These are Senate only. These sections modify the time period in which a healthcare provider and a health plan company is currently required to provide a consumer with a good faith estimate of the allowable payment that the provider has agreed to accept as payment. And the new time period is 5 business days if the consumer has health coverage and 3 business days if the consumer is uninsured. House Section 12 and Senate Section 3, they establish requirements for timely provider credential determination by a health plan company. These sections are identical except for a very minor technical difference. On the next page, House Section 13 and 18, these are House only, and they remove references again to the Affordable Care Act and require the Commissioner of Commerce to determine the items and services that are considered preventive, and they then require, the sections also require the commissioner to provide health plan companies with the list of which items and services must be categorized by the health plan company as preventive. House Section 14, that's a House only section. This prohibits a health plan company from placing a lifetime or annual limit on screenings and urinalysis testing for opioids for enrollees that are in substance use disorder treatment programs. Senate Section 4, this is Senate only. The Senate section requires a health plan company to include in the summary of benefits a statement indicating whether funds from a patient assistance program will be applied to an enrollee's deductible requirements of that enrollee's health plan. House Section 15 is a House only section. This section requires the Commissioner of Commerce to determine the maximum annual out-of-pocket limits that apply to individual and small group health plans. House Section 16 is a House only section, and this removes references to the ACA. It also specifies what is and is not included in cost sharing, and it requires that the different levels of health plans must be actuarially equivalent to certain percentage of the actuarial value of the benefits provided by those plans, and it also defines essential benefits for individual and small group health plans. House Section 17 is a House-only section, and this section specifies that medical assistance covers screening and urinalysis tests for opioids without a lifetime or annual benefits. So MA cannot establish lifetime or annual benefits for these certain tests. And that's the health insurance article.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Ms. Cavanaugh. Again, this is really helpful. So we are actually have 10 minutes left in this conference committee hearing. Are there comments from members or questions on any of what we've gone through here? We've gone through quickly, but I do find this really helpful, and I think it's going to help us get to some agreements. Questions, comments, going once, going twice. All right. I'm not seeing anything. I think 3 hours is a long time to sit in a hearing, even virtually. I contemplated whether I should have perhaps given us a 5-minute break in the middle, but I think of this, we went through very, very well, and I really appreciate everybody's time. We think we've had some really good discussion today. So tomorrow, Senator Benson will have the gavel. And Senator Benson, do you want to give us a preview or make any comment before we adjourn here?
Madam Chair, some of this will be dependent on what language we have in front of us. And Senator Abler has some different challenges with a Saturday hearing. And so as language becomes available, we would prioritize Senator Abler's sections of the bill would be my intention for tomorrow, but we will know more later.
All right. Thank you. And, you know, for members, of course, and for members of the public, this will all be posted so everyone will get advance notice. Senator Abler?
Unmuting. That's going to be the joke of the century, all this unmuting business. Mute yourself, unmute. And actually, my challenge, Madam Chair, is really with Friday morning. But so I appreciate the consideration. Would it be appropriate, and I know you don't know the future, to both the chairs, just to help our viewers at home and members of this conference committee, do you think you're going to meet most every time you can, like 6 days a week? If you even offer what you premeditated so people can kind of plan ahead? That's all I have. Thank you.
Well, of course, you know, depending on who has the gavel, that person has a lot of autonomy over what they do. And I know Senator Benson and I try to coordinate as closely as we can, because I think we have a very good cooperative relationship, and I expect that will continue. We both want this to be as smooth as possible. My intention right now is to try to use every meeting we've got. And I know this is maybe different than what we do when we're in person, but because of the constraints around making sure we've got broadcast time and letting the public have as much visibility into our process as possible, even though it is a very difficult, complicated process, my intention is to try to use every meeting that's available to us and to structure the rest of what we're doing around that. So I think it will force us to be ready and have some offline conversations and try to use those spots, because we've discussed this, Senator Benson and I, that we have very little time available to do a huge amount of work. So I think we're going to have to put pedal to the metal here and use every available minute. Senator Benson?
Thank you, Representative Liebling. To the extent that we're not walking through side-by-sides in the most comprehensive way, I think you're right, these summary documents will be helpful. But the sooner we can get to adopting language, I think the public will see how effective we're going to be. And so I would like to use every hearing that we have available to do productive, transparent work for the public. And to the extent we need to settle some things out and do vetting with stakeholders on language we can do that outside of our scheduled time. I also believe that we would have some access to evening hearings. And I think Representative Schultz also mentioned that as other committees might start wrapping up, we could use their time as well. Broadcast does make it more complicated, but as soon as we get a target, we're going to have a tremendous amount of work to do. The more we can front load decision making and vetting, the easier it will be.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Senator. Okay. Anything else anyone wants to comment or any questions anyone has? All right, not seeing anything. So once again, really a lot of appreciation to all of our staff, both those who presented today and those who are working behind the scenes to make this all work. It's a tremendously heavy lift for everyone, and we really appreciate everyone's sticking with us and working as hard as all of you do. So with that, we will see you tomorrow, and we stand adjourned.